Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:38 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is January 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening in the last week, this has been really quite a positive week for stock markets, and not least the S&P, which has closed on a new recovery high, and that's at 1485, almost 1486. So it's breaking upwards to its highest level in over 4 years, which is a not inconsiderable feat. And in Europe, the FTSE 100 has increased its advance above the 6,000 level. And 6,000 has been a bit of a psychological Rubicon. It's gone up and tested that level on a number of occasions over the last 2 years and has finally broken upwards and appears to be sustaining that gain. And that's also really quite positive. And European stock markets generally have been really quite steady. They surged along with Wall Street in the first week of January, but whereas Wall Street has been able to improve on that performance, the majority in Europe have been a little bit less quick to advance. The FTSE has been probably the best performer, certainly among them, and the CAC 40 in France was breaking upwards earlier on today, but finished down very marginally on the day. But by and large, what we have is really quite a positive equity environment in North America and in Europe. And Canada, which has been a bit of a wallflower, has moved to a position of outperformance. And it does now look like we're going to see additional gains for the Canadian market. While Europe and the US have been quite positive, the Nikkei was stronger again today by an additional almost 3%, and the Hang Seng pushed on to a new recovery high. And that's also important because the Hong Kong market has been largely range-bound for much of the last couple of years. And the Singapore market is also showing signs of life. In Japan, the index is really linked to the weakness of the yen. And the yen had such a weak day yesterday, by more than a full yen against the US dollar, that was inevitably going to follow through. And we saw additional upside by the Nikkei in here today. And it's back above the 10,000 level, which has also been a psychological area for Japan. And as long as the Bank of Japan continues to weaken the currency, that's likely to add a corresponding tailwind to the domestic stock market. The currency markets have been quite volatile this week, and the euro, having got right up to look at $1.34, has pulled back somewhat, and the British pound has been quite weak and is from a high today of 160, it closed out today at 158.74. So that has been pulling back rather sharply. We are in a situation with Japan so aggressively devaluing its currency that it is throwing into sharp contrast the policies of other central banks. And the Bank of England was among the first central banks back in 2007 to devalue its currency, and it got its devaluation in first, and it was able to shelter the UK economy during the worst of the credit crisis by that devaluation. The yen is coming from an extraordinarily strong level, so it has substantial room in which to devalue. And when compared to the US dollar, the yen has been trending lower against the US dollar for decades. So there is significant potential for additional upside here. But when one looks at the dollar and compares it to the euro, we are presented with a much more range-bound environment. And that probably reflects the fiscal problems that both currency regions have. At Fuller Money, we've long exhibited a favoritism for the currencies of countries with strong trade balances and fiscal responsibility. And that has been primarily in the Asian region. And the performance of the JP Morgan Asia Dollar Index is particularly noteworthy over the last couple of months, because that is also another index which had been largely range-bound for much of the last year to 18 months, but it broke upwards before Christmas, and it's improved on that performance. When one looks at the constituents of that index, the renminbi remains on an appreciating trajectory. And Thailand this week was particularly noteworthy. The stock market went on to hit new highs, and the baht has strengthened right back to its strongest level since the devaluation of the Asian financial crisis. And given the trend and the consistency and the competitive advantage of some of the economies in the Asian region, it's still a very realistic possibility that we're going to see an increasing number of Asian currencies retrace their entire depreciation from the Asian financial crisis. And you can find those 20 and 30 year charts in the chart library, and they are worth looking at because it gives us an idea not only of how much their original devaluations were, but how strong they are at present. In the very short term, we're presented with short-term overbought conditions in a number of markets in Asia. The Philippines is a very good example. The Philippine peso has been strengthening, and the stock market has been benefiting from that as global investors get both the appreciation of the currency and the appreciation of the stock market. But it is becoming increasingly overextended, and it is susceptible to a pullback. And it's quite a similar story with Turkey, which has had such an impressive run over the last few months, but it is becoming increasingly overextended relative to its 200-day moving average and is susceptible to a pullback. And the New Zealand market, which has benefited from the stimulus following the Christchurch earthquakes, has also become somewhat overextended right here and is susceptible to some pullback and consolidation. What we're also seeing, and it's a trend that has been evident now for a number of months, but is certainly starting to pick up pace, is that the industrial sector is perhaps the sector that is the one to watch in 2013. In the USA, you have Honeywell and Tyco International and GE and a number of other industrials breaking out of really quite lengthy ranges and moving to positions of outperformance relative to the wider market. And when I post comment of the day today, you'll see that there's a considerable number of offshore drilling and oil services companies that are in the process of completing, in some cases, 2 and in some cases 4 year ranges to push on to new recovery highs. And considering the fact that the focus of attention has been on shale gas and shale oil and the potential for US or North American energy independence and a significantly improving trade balance for the US, but the corollary of that very impressive move and the game-changing nature of this massive supply surge in North America is that it's putting downward pressure on prices. And broadly speaking, it's rather difficult to find a shale gas producer, and I've only found 3, that are really showing signs of demand dominance. The vast majority have overpaid for their resources and are having difficulty keeping up with the supply schedule, because one of the side effects of hydraulic fracturing is that most of these wells hit their peak very early on, and it necessitates that you have to continue drilling. And natural gas prices have fallen. to such an extent that there's quite a large amount of natural gas production is uneconomic below $4. And today we're at $3.56. And that's already after prices almost doubled from just under $2 over the last 6 months. So we're presented with really a very favorable environment in terms of the energy complex, because we're seeing that there's plenty of supply. It's bringing downward prices. And that is a tailwind for the wider economy. And that is at least part of the reason that we're seeing the industrial complex really starting to benefit here. It's important for the US economy because labor has become a bit more pliable over the last couple of decades. And that's improved competitiveness. And energy is an additional competitive edge. And housing has started to turn upwards. And we've been through a massive recapitalization of the banking sector, and the diversified financials in particular have turned upwards. And US banks do look like they're going to complete their base and start to push upwards from here. And that's really quite impressive action. And one sort of important point is that the UK has lagged the USA by about a year. So when US home builders had broken upwards, then we saw UK home builders breaking upwards about a year later. And US banks really started to outperform about a year ago and then spent quite a bit of time ranging. And now we're seeing that UK banks have really put in an incredibly impressive advance over the last number of months. And they're becoming a little bit overbought in the very short term. And they are susceptible to a ranging phase once this impressive momentum move has run its course. But this is still very positive action. And it's consistent with a recovery. And this is a slow recovery, and it's a difficult recovery, and it's coming off a very low base. But that doesn't mean that it's not a recovery. And it's important. So while if we take a step back and we look at what Wall Street has been doing for the last 10 years, we've characterized it as a generation-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And we've certainly had a good deal of that. And the environment has been characterized by a great deal of ranging. And that has been really very, quite extraordinary ranging and quite volatile. Now, the volatility has probably increased in the last 4 or 5 years, not least because of high-frequency trading. But the broad environment is one where the average investor has become really disappointed and disillusioned with the equity markets because they're not willing to sit with this type of volatility. And demand for equities has deteriorated. And in addition to that, supply of equities is now also deteriorating. There are an increasing number of companies that have been taken private, and there are an increasing number of companies that are buying back their own shares. And that makes good financial sense for a large number of companies, because often they're paying out more in their dividend than they can borrow money at. And we're seeing an increasing number of companies borrowing in the debt markets and accessing the lowest yields that they've been able to get in literally generations, and going out there and buying their own shares back. Now, some might argue that that hides weakness in the balance sheet, and in some cases that might be the case. But when we look at the group of autonomies, and we see that these are companies that are leveraged to the global economy, and they have a truly global presence, and they generate more than 40% of their respective revenue from outside their domestic markets, and they're leaders in their respective niches, and they have globally recognizable brands. These are like small principalities from the early modern period, and they've outgrown their respective domestic markets. They can cite their operations anywhere, and they are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. One of the reasons that Asia is doing so well is because it has such favorable demographics. And We've seen literally a billion people lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes over the last decade in Asia, particularly in China and in India. But with the global economy continuing to grow and global population expected to expand by an additional 2 billion people in the next 20 to 30 years, the capacity for the global economy to absorb an additional 2 billion middle class consumers is virtually certain at this stage. And that is driving a bull market in globally present companies. So while Wall Street has been largely range-bound for the last decade, and investor interest has deteriorated, and the majority of investors are piling into bonds and driving yields even lower as they look at the Bernanke put and say that they're always going to support the bond market, what we're presented with is a number of very large companies that have completed more than decade-long ranges and are already pushing on to new high ground. And that at least partially helps to explain the outperformance of the Dow relative to the S&P over the last 3 or 4 years, because so many of those autonomy-type companies are listed and are present on the Dow Jones. And when we look at the global economy, one of the major headwinds that we've had over the last decade has been high energy prices. And that's still a risk in the short term. But the risk of a spike higher in energy prices is receding at this stage. And because the unconventional oil and gas boom is unlikely to remain a purely North American phenomenon, and because we have such a large amount of additional supply due to come online from offshore, then energy prices could begin to trend lower over the next decade. And that would add an additional tailwind to the global economy. I did an interview with Jim Poplava on Wednesday, and I think it's going to be aired on the 27th. But what's really interesting is that we're seeing so many of these companies breaking out and nobody really wants to know about it. But also that people have become disillusioned with the ability of central banks to protect their purchasing power. And that has been the case now for at least the last decade. And gold has been among the best performing assets over that time period. And it's put in a positive performance every year for the last 11 consecutive years. And it's particularly relevant at this stage because gold has been going sideways now for about 17 months. And it has been prone to these 18 to 19 month consolidations over the last 10 years. And it's been consolidating here in the region of between $1,650 and $1,700 for the last month. Platinum and palladium have already pushed upwards, and platinum tested the $1,700 level today and has encountered some resistance in there this week. And it really is now to be seen how much of its advance it can hold within this consolidation and whether it's going to be able to sustain a move above $1,700. But palladium has been leading to the upside. And if we're correct, and this has been a lengthy consolidation for gold, then at some point this year it will push through $1,700 and then $1,800 and onto new all-time highs. And gold and gold's bull market is reflective of the loss of confidence in the ability of central banks to retain our purchasing power. And the financial repression that has been in evidence now for nearly 5 years is easily observed in the fact that we have negative real interest rates. So while we've had banks recapitalized via the yield curve, and while borrowers are being enticed into this market with very low interest rates, savers are seeing the value of their savings eroded by a couple of percent a year. And when we look at yields where they are right now, they're completely dependent on government intervention. And I've seen a number of arguments cross my desk in the last few weeks talking about the not only that the Fed will probably continue on its course to continue to buy up bonds and keep yields low, but that it will have to, and that it is a foregone conclusion that quantitative easing will be with us forever. And that is seen as by far the most bullish argument. In other words, what people are actually starting to argue is that yields will go down forever. But nothing ever happens, or no market ever moves in a straight line in perpetuity. So when we heard people saying that property prices only go up, or that earnings don't matter, they were contradictory statements. And when people say that government bond yields can only go down because governments will always have to buy them, then that has the ring of a circular argument. So it becomes then a question for investors as to just what are we going to do? Because government bonds continue to represent a low volatility consistent trend, particularly on a total return basis. And in that case, we cannot say that this major bull market has ended. But we'll know what it looks like when it does, and when those total return indices lose their consistency, and when we start to see yields pushing higher, then we'll be presented with a difficult environment. And anyone who has been piling into bonds at such low yields at that stage is going to be sitting on substantial losses. And the question really is, to what extent one needs to hold bonds when we're presented with well-capitalized companies that yield in some cases double what you're getting on a 10-year treasury, and with the prospect to increase that payout over time and leverage to the growth of the global economy rather than any domestic economy. So that is a concern for the long term. I did an extensive piece this week about inflation-adjusted pricing for commodities. And what we've seen is that whereas it was a bullish environment for just about all commodities between about 2002 and 2008, that's no longer the case. And what we're now seeing is that each commodity is being addressed on its own individual merits. And perhaps the most important thing that is happening right now that's likely to have an impact on commodity prices is China, because China has moved aggressively now to readjust sentiment towards the economy and towards the stock market. And it's particularly targeting the stock market, because changing the rules under which insurance companies can invest their premiums so that they can hold more bank shares is a quick way of stoking interest in the banking sector. And the banking sector is, I think, the biggest sector in the wider market. And raising the limits on the qualified foreign investor investments are also important, because the majority of funds tend to track the index, and because banks are by far the largest shares on that index, then that also creates additional demand for those shares. Now, we see that the next 5-year plan is devoted to the consumer and improving the lives of ordinary Chinese and attempting to unleash their massive savings in an effort to stoke economic growth without a reliance on the export sector and property development. Of course, there will be property development, and there'll be affordable housing built, and more railways and subway systems built. And to the extent that that occurs, that's likely to have an outsized effect on the industrial mining sector. We've seen this week that Rio Tinto changed its CEO, and probably not before time in the eyes of some investors. And the share rallied rather impressively off its lows in the last couple of days. But more importantly, it found support just where it needed to, which was the upper side of the underlying range. And BHP is in a quite a similar story. And because we're seeing the industrial complex more generally, from manufacturers to chemical companies to the industrial metal miners starting to move upwards, that's really quite positive for the global economy. And everyone has written off the US economy as an economy that is going to grow on a subpar basis for a considerable amount of time. And we don't have a great deal of evidence yet to suggest that that is wrong. But with the competitive advantage that it has in energy, that could change the balance here. And what happens if the US economy starts to grow a bit quicker? And that might be, in many eyes, a best-case scenario. But if that's the case, it will shake the Fed into action, and they'll start to raise interest rates. But if they start to raise interest rates, that would be the end of quantitative easing. And if it's the end of quantitative easing, we're going to see government bond yields go up a lot. So even in a best-case scenario, be careful what you wish for. And in a worst-case scenario, then we will see those bond yields continuing to move lower, and the domestic economy will continue to remain rather moribund. But when we look at the global economy, and particularly the ASEAN region, and in China and in India, then we're presented with the center of global economic growth, and that's likely to continue for a considerable period. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and wish all the best to all of you.